Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Had some small technical issues. If you are listening in, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167. So that's area code 267-521-0167. I'd like to give some updates. The Mental Patients Liberation Alliance's 34th annual, the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Days demonstration and vigil will be held on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health July 13th at 6 p.m. to July 19th at 6 p.m. July 13th, 6 p.m. to July 16th at 6 p.m. We sit vigil for 72 hours because 72 hours is how long they can detain, assess, and treat any of us. It's imperative that we speak out and let people know that this is what is occurring and why we need to as a movement and as a people, stand up and say that this cannot happen to us any longer. It's not only that they can treat us and assess us and for 72 hours, but if they choose, they can then keep us for the duration, for however long they see fit. And very often, the determining factor as to whether or not somebody is held and institutionalized is whether or not they're willing to comply with what it is they're given. And in some strange ways, it's very sad because the reverse happens, that if somebody is not is seeking treatment, wanting treatment, asking for help, asking for assistance, asking for psychiatric drugs, very often they're refused. And so the people who are refusing are forced, and the people who are requesting are refused. And so it really creates a bad situation for everyone. So 72 hours, we will sit vigil with the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance July 13th through the July 16th to celebrate the Bastille Day event. July 24th through July 27th in Connecticut will be Mind Freedom International's 2014 Creative Revolution Conference. I will also be at that, and I think that it is definitely something worth attending and finding out more information about, which you can get at www.mindfreedom.org. Today there was some interesting show on C-SPAN which I caught. I do have a caller here, area code 613. Hi, your line is open. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
Good, thanks, Sue. How are you? Hello? Sue, are you there? I think your line may have, it still shows that your line is on, but you may have just dropped. Okay, so anyway, if you're listening, call back in. I'm having some kind of monster technical issues going on tonight, but we will get it all straightened out and have this come in. Okay, let's see if this works. Sue, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am. Somehow I lost the call. Sorry about that, Lauren. I have something to say. I saw something very terrible. In 89 that my ex-boyfriend, Stefan, we were both at the Ottawa General Hospital psychiatric ward. I went to his bedroom and I said, something is wrong with him. He was shaking, eh? So I went and I yelled to the nurse. They had taken him off his meds cold turkey. I saw, okay, the two male nurses walking him. His eyes were rolling right in the back of his head. He had seizures. He almost died because they took him off his pills cold turkey. I was so upset seeing it. I thought as soon as, because they walked him by, like they walked him up and down, and I couldn't, it was horrible. It was like a nightmare. And I saw that with my own eyes.
Oh my. The withdrawal from these drugs is something that is so important that people need to know. That just stopping taking them immediately can be just as dangerous as continuing to take them. I often will point to the harm reduction guide for coming off of psychiatric drugs as a way that has been put forward to try to help people give with a guidebook to give some information about how to do it safely. I'm just trying to get to the website right now. People aren't informed about the idea that they think that because these are prescribed that they're safe and effective and that they're not like street drugs in that way, that they wouldn't cause some kind of withdrawal process. But this actually happened in an institution, you're saying?
Yes, it was at the Ottawa General Hospital, and it was on the psych ward on the fourth floor, and I saw this with my own eyes because I went to his bedroom to say, wake up, it's breakfast, and he was in his bed shaking in convulsions, and I was terrified. I went and ran for the nurse. I said, hey, there's something wrong here. And then I saw these men, like the orderlies, come in. They walked him around, and there I saw his eyes rolling around in his head back and forth, and he was shaking like a seizure. And I was horrified. I remember that like it was yesterday because his psychiatrist took him off his pills cold turkey. He told me. He said, last night the doctor said, we're going to take you off your pills cold turkey. I said, I don't think that's a good thing. I said, I went cold turkey too, and I had seizures, I told him. I said, I think you're going to have problems with that, eh? He said, I told the doctor, don't do that, and he said, I am.
And then what happens?
Well, then after that, he was in bed for a few days, and then I'll tell you that in group therapy, a week later, where you sit around and talk to the doctor and nurse, and he yelled at him and said, why did you do that? Right in front of all the patients in group therapy. I said, good for you, Stefan. I said, good for you. You told him off right in front of the psychiatrist. He yelled at him because he was outraged.
I want to point people to www.willhall.net/coming-off-meds, and there you can find the harm reduction guide to coming off of psychiatric drugs and withdrawal. And it was put together as part of the Icarus Project and Freedom Center's efforts. It's a 52-page illustrated guide, and it was written by Will Hall with a 55-member health professional advisory board providing research assistance, I'm reading here, and more than 50 collaborators involved in developing and editing. And so I think it actually is now in a second revised and expanded edition, and And it's got a Creative Commons copyright, which is great because you have advanced permission to link, copy, print, and distribute for non-commercial purposes, as long as you don't alter it and you credit the sources. And it's also written in multiple languages. It's in Spanish, German, Greek, Bosnian, Croatian, Japanese, Italian, French, Norwegian, Czech, and English. And so if you're somebody who may be thinking about psychiatric drugs and or stopping psychiatric drugs, to realize there are a lot of people who have put in a lot of efforts in how to do that safely. And, you know, one of the things that I get complaints about, Sue, all the time from people is that they can't find a psychiatrist who's willing to titrate them down, and that they can't find somebody who's willing to get them off the drugs. And so very often people get frustrated and they just go cold turkey like that, and then it can become a problem. When I stopped, I did stop cold turkey because it was long, long ago, before any of this kind of stuff was, and it was very painful and very rough, and all of a sudden all of this, but there wasn't that kind of information back then. And so I think that there's ways that people can do it safely, but for this to have happened in an institution, this sounds like a real not too thoughtful of people who are providing services there.
And another thing I want to talk to you about, Lauren, is about chemical restraints. I was in 1972, I was 1972, that I was 17 years old, and I was at the Royal, it's called the Ottawa Hospital, a mental hospital, a psychiatric hospital on Carling Avenue in Ottawa. Now, I was a mouthy teenager, so I guess that you can think of what I would say when they wanted to give me medication. I would say the F word, okay? I'm not going to say it, like, because I know it's not nice, and I would tell them, I'm not crazy, I think you better go talk to my mother. I'm mad, but I'm not crazy. And I used to yell and scream because I was never, well, I was on a locked ward, and I said, get me off this ward, I'm not the crazy one. See, my mother used to abuse me. And I would yell, and they said, Suzanne, my really, Suzanne, calm down because you're going to disturb the patients. I said, I don't care. I want to get out of this hellhole. I said, you're torturing me. So then they call a code, ding, 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 whatever the code is for the, you know, the men in white to come and grab you. I was a disturbance, they said. And I'd say, come and get me, you so-and-so. Now, I'm not going to say the word, Lauren. I know the respect on the radio. I said, come and get me, you so-and-sos. I won't say the word. And they would run and grab me. I was about 120 pounds, and they had to grab me by the two arms and two legs and drag me into my room, put me on my stomach, pull my hip, my pants down to my hip, and give me a big needle. They wanted to shut me up, and I was sedated for 12 hours. And chemical restraints are against the law. I got lots of them on the wards, lots of them, because I was a mouthy kid.
That is just awful, and it kind of makes you wonder what are these people really thinking, that, and what level do they think that this is going to be something that is going to ultimately help somebody of you know to stop. And I think with young people specifically, that so much of what they're experiencing can be dealt with in ways of just treating them with respect and listening and you know, finding out if they're being abused, finding out if they're having other kinds of problems in their social experiences, or, you know, and if they're being abused, to first and foremost address that abuse. And that doesn't happen too often, do you think?
No, I don't think so. And also, another bad experience I saw, in 1989, I was at the same hospital that my ex-boyfriend and I went to, the Ottawa General Hospital Psych Ward, in 1989. I shared a room with a young girl about 17. I was about in my late 20s, okay? And I went to the room right after lunch, and the girl was crying. She had red hair, a nice young teenager. I said, what's wrong? They said, they're coming to put the restraints on my arms and tie me to the bed. I said, what? So I said, really, legally? Like, I don't think they can do that. And I was an advocate by then. I had a mini breakdown, and I went to the hospital. So the nurse came in and said, Suzanne, get out of this room. I said, I'm going to stay here. I'm not going to leave my bed. I said, I haven't done anything wrong. And she said to the young girl, okay, I'll call her Mary. She said, Mary, you were very bad today. You started yelling at the staff. I said, well, she must have had a good reason. And the nurse said, Suzanne, shut up and be quiet. I said, and so the nurse started to put the restraints on her legs, and she went hysterical. This young girl went screaming, and I said, listen, nurse, I am an advocate. You better put those off, I said, because it's against the law. I said, I am Sue Clark. I am, and I said, okay, I might be in the psych ward. I'm not crazy. And I said, and this young girl is going hysterical because you're putting these leather straps on her arms and legs, and she went hysterical. And then the nurse took off the straps, and the girl went calm. In about 5 minutes, she was calm. She said, thanks, Sue. I remember her going terrible. Her eyes were really and screaming at the top. She said, get these restraints off me now. And she went hysterical. As soon as the girl put it around one leg, went hysterical. So
I just think that's another
bad experience, okay?
And it's something that, you know, comes up from time to time on the show, but that is regularly talked about by people who are in the system. The use of restraints and seclusion, that this is torture, and it is not treatment, and it is not helpful, and it is not good. And the idea that somebody can come and, you know, four or five people holding you down on the floor, putting you into a bed, strapping you down to a bed with leather, and then often shooting you up with some kind of sedative, that these things are torture, and that these aren't helpful, and that they're not the way to go. I think that really we should do a whole show just on the use of restraints and seclusion and inform people about this, because even though the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture has ruled seclusion and restraint as torture, that it is still being used as a violation of the Convention Against Torture. It is still used, and in some states much more than others, and it's a really big problem. I want to give the number. It's area code 267-521-0167. If you're out there listening and like to talk about something, give a call. Area code 267-521-0167. Sue, we're going to have a special show on Wednesday night. It's coming close.
And I can't wait. I'm so excited.
Yes, and it's for any of you who are listening, it's going to be a Wednesday night special. So it will start at 8 p.m. Eastern and run through 10 p.m. And it is going to be on Electroshock, A Crime Against Humanity. And Sue is going to be one of the guests, and was really one of the people who prompted this special to be created. And so I'm very excited about that. Other people who will be joining in are Don White, who is a insulin shock survivor, George Ebert of the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, Dr. John Breeding, Dr. Brenda LeFrancois, and Loretta Wilson, who also is a shock survivor, who has been doing some phenomenal work around trying to get the FDA to respond to its own prompting of lowering the device or keeping it as a Class 3 experimental device. Sue, would you like to give people a little insight into maybe what you'll be talking about and why you think this is an important show? And
okay, Lauren, I'll tell you that in 1973, I was 17, I was at the Royal Ottawa Hospital on Carling Avenue in Ottawa, Canada. I was depressed because I was abused horribly by my mom, my dad, and my uncle at 4 years old. He molested me, but I was severely physically abused by my mother. She was right out of it, so to speak. Anyhow, so in 1973, I went into my room. Before that, I went to the craft room, and I found the macrame for making these big planters. I put it around my neck and put it on the door, you know, on top of the door, and I was trying to hang myself. And a nurse was looking for me because I wasn't there at lunch, and she grabbed me. She said, yell, get the scissors quick, and she saved my life. Then I had the 48-hour one-to-one where they sit by your door. They follow you to the washroom. If you're taking a bath, they're right there. And I was suicidal, of course. And before that, they warned me because I'd gone to the ROH hospital from the spring of 72 to the March of 73, in and out like a revolving door. So they warned me, if you get angry or suicidal again, they told me, we're going to send you to Brockville, the long-term care facility in Brockville, Ontario, which is 60 miles away from Ottawa. So they put me in a little ambulance with a box of my, you know, my shoes, my coat and stuff, eh? So I went to Brockville, and I went to Ward 4, a current ward in a little building. And as soon as I got there, they checked the box of stuff, and they put me on a locked ward. And it was rooms that had half a wall and then curtains. I was on the woman's side, and then, of course, it was a man's side, okay? So what happened was I was there from March of 73 till September 73, 6 months. So Dr. Louis Cyprus, my psychiatrist, a big man, he used to smoke a cigar, and he used to put his feet up on the desk. Suzanne, I have something for your treatment of your depression. I said, what is that, Dr. Cyprus? Well, it's a very good treatment. We put electricity through your brain, and it's a short minute, and then you'll be better. I said, doctor, I said, it feels like you're going to fry my brain like an egg. Oh, no, Suzanne, nothing's going to happen. You know, you might come out of it a little bit confused, a little bit of memory loss, but, you know, you're going to be okay. I said, I don't want this. I'm 17. I don't want this. He said, well, you're going to have it. I'm signing for this, and your father signed for it, too. I said, what? So I was really upset. Eh? A week later, I was on the ward. They said, Suzanne, we're going to take you to the ECT room down the hallway. I said, no. And a peer of mine, Jean, years ago, told me, because I bumped into her downtown in Ottawa, she said, you screamed and yelled and you bit the staff. She said, you were horrified. I said, she said, I couldn't listen to your screams. I said, somebody help me, please help me, help me, help me. And, I mean, the patients couldn't help me. So they put me in this room, a white-walled room, painted white. There was a bed there. They said, get on your back. Well, I had no choice, eh? And then they put a rubber, band around my head. They gave me a needle to help me relax because years ago before, they wouldn't, if they didn't get a needle, sometimes they broke their back because they had a seizure and their back would go up and break it. And then they put a rubber mullet.
This is before they would use anesthesia then.
Exactly. And I had a friend, and she said that her sister at the there in Toronto Mental Health Hospital there broke her back. She had a seizure, and they had no anesthesia to help her, sedation, and she broke her back. Carol's sister broke her back. Anyhow, so I'm going to go in quickly. Anyhow, I was screaming, I don't want this. Who do you think you are, you bunch of so-and-sos? I was really frightened. I was scared out of my mind. So I looked at the box to the left of me, a little box about a foot long and about 6 inches high. I said, is that it? They said, yes. And so what they did, gave me the needle, and I started to go, out of it. I'm not out of it, but I went to sleep, eh? Then when I got up, okay, they put me in a wheelchair, and I said to a nurse outside the room, who am I? Where am I? What's going on? I forgot who I was. I didn't even know where I was. It was scary. So I missed my breakfast. And I had electroshock for breakfast. And what happened was I had a friend on the ward called Joan. She's about 40. She had about 100 electroshocks in her life. She was in and out of Brockville several years. Eh? And I said, Joan, I want to tell you something. I had electroshock. She said, what did you say? She could only remember half a sentence at a time. You have to repeat the sentence 10 times before she got it. She's very smart, but she had a breakdown. I think her marriage broke up or something, and she could not remember a sentence because of the electroshock. She had about 100 of them, she told me. And so then the nurse said, okay, next week you're going to have two more. So I had one, two, three, four, five. On my fifth one, I don't remember exactly what happened, but the next week I said, I was supposed to have more. I said, I don't want them. She says you're not going to have any more because your heart stopped and we had to revive you on the fifth one. You're not having any more. I said, thank you, God. Thank you. Thank you very much for saving me. I didn't want no more. And that's what she said. And you know what? I'll tell you something, okay? Electroshock almost killed me, okay? And I'm lucky to be alive to talk to you, Lauren, and to the people, all my peers out there, the people listening. Now, I became an activist because of my friend, Don Weitz. He had a magazine called The Phoenix Rising. I called him. I saw the magazine on it. He said, start a group, and I did. Now, in 2005, my husband, Stephen Winberg, and I, okay, we founded the, it's called the International Campaign to Ban Electroshock. Now, our group is trying to help ban the ECT all over the world, okay? There's 100,000 people in America, the U.S., that get electroshock. Most of it is forced. And in the world, 1 to 2 million people are forced to have electroshock. Some is voluntary, but most of it is, you call it...
Wait, 1 to 2 million
people every year across the world are getting electroshock. Most of it is forced.
And people don't even realize that this is still occurring, right? That mm-hmm. this is the big secret that needs to be exposed.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people ask me, well, it must be better because years ago I said, Dr. Bregan says it's worse, that it's a bigger voltage than before. So the myth is, oh, you know, it's now 2014, so it's not as bad. Yes, it is. The voltage is even worse, Dr. Bregan said.
Right, and that there's such a so many potential side effects, and plus anesthesia now, which they argue that is safer. But if you're overweight, anesthesia itself is considered a high risk procedure. And I actually for an operation, not for ECT, but when I had to have an operation, I actually died on the table under anesthesia. And so people don't realize that it's not just the complications from ECT, which is absolutely a crime against humanity, but then there's also this additional risk of the anesthesia, which can cause death also.
Mm-hmm.
And people, and then muscle relaxers and painkillers and whatever other drugs they have people on. I do want to mention, because you brought up Don Weitz, and he is going to be on air with us on Wednesday mm-hmm. night from 8 to 10 p.m. for this special. Mm-hmm. And if people want to check out Phoenix Rising, you can actually see the journal, which has multiple volumes. I think it's 8 volumes, which mm-hmm. can be found at www.psychiatricsurvivorarchives.com/phoenix.html. That's psychiatricsurvivorarchives.com/phoenix.html. And you can also find there a ton of other information about the psychiatric survivor movement in Canada, which I think is important that people realize that this is an international movement of people who have been subject to psychiatry, who are... fighting back and trying to educate others as to what is going on. And Sue, when this happened to you and your heart stopped, how old were you?
I was 17 years old, Lauren.
17 years old. So the idea that we are doing this to people, young people, I know in New York State it's legal to use on young people, but the potential for death and other kinds of terrible side effects, broken bones, all kinds of issues, and memory loss. The memory loss of how when I was at the FDA hearings in 2011 and people would talk about that 30% or 40% of one's memory being wiped out isn't really a big deal. And I don't know how anybody could suggest that somebody losing their memory isn't a big deal, but especially that much of it, and with no control over what memory is being wiped out. And so some people don't remember specifics about their lives. Some people's entire education gets wiped out. Some people, you know, that this is a major issue that is a side effect that is taken so lightly. Oh, you might not remember some things, like it's nothing, but it's something. It's very significant.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, when you talk with other survivors of electroshock, does this issue come up a lot, or is this something that they just say, oh, it's not really a big deal?
Yes, I know a lot of survivors, okay, that had electroshock, and I know some of them that had 150, 75, and the main complaint is that they have a very hard time to learn something new, and that their memory is also very, very bad, like mine. Now, what happened to me is that I have a very bad short-term memory, and I'll tell you that in 1995, okay, that I went to the University of Carleton, and I took studies, and anyhow, I'll tell you, before I had electroshock, I never had a learning problem. I was A in my class. I got A's in my class. But what happened at university, I could not remember what I was learning. So I had to leave the university after 3 months. It wasn't because I didn't have the aptitude. I didn't have the memory. I got a C+, and I said, I have to leave because I can't remember. I go to all these lectures, and I couldn't remember half of what they said. Like, you know the professor would be talking a mile a minute. I couldn't even remember one sentence.
So just to frame this for anybody who may be listening, it's not only that you, memories of your life that you've already lived that you may have some trouble remembering or that may be totally wiped out and that you have no recollection of, but it's also then future memory that is affected in terms of learning and ability to store information and follow, that there are then cognitive, negative cognitive effects that occur after the electroshock, and that this is persistent, that it's not just for 10 minutes after the electroshock, but that it's a permanent brain damage that is caused by the electroshock, right? Would that be right?
Yes, and I'll tell you what, and you're right, Lauren, 100% exact, and what Dr. Bregan said, that there's many studies done that has proven that electroshock causes brain damage every time. There's proof. If you go
to
Bregan, BREGGIN.com, he has articles proving that when you have an electroshock, it will cause brain damage every time you have it or are forced to have it.
Right, and that the original intent of electroshock was to shock and control. The original articles about this was to shock and control people, and that brain damage as a side effect as was the goal. That this was part of the goal. And I do urge people to go check out Dr. Peter Bregan's website at bregan.com, BREGGIN. And he gives all kinds of information, not about only about electroshock, but about the drugs and about alternatives that could be used, and really has been for decades trying to expose, truths about psychiatry that doctors either are not telling people or may not even know themselves for whatever reason that they're not doing that. And I'm just reading off of his website that Dr. Bregan acts as a medical expert in criminal malpractice and product liability suits, often involving adverse drug effects such as suicide, violence, brain injury, death, and tardive dyskinesia. And so he's been involved in a ton of stuff. And also psychrights.org, the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, has a really good amount of information about these things, too, and about legal ramifications of people. And so it's very important that people try to get as much information as they can about these things. And I think that the show with Sue on Wednesday night and others is going to be really informative and hopefully will produce some great actions coming out of it in the future. Sue, we do have another caller on area code 845. If you'd like to stay on the line, please do.
Yes.
845, your line is open.
Hi, Lauren. It's Anthony from Rockland again.
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for calling in earlier tonight. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good.
Hi, Sue.
Would you be willing to just give an overview of people where we left off last night, and then so that we can catch people up, and then take it from there?
Sure. Basically, what I was talking about last night was about my own situation. Hello? Am I on my
ear? Yes. Yep, you're there.
I'm sorry. I thought I got disconnected. The thing I was talking about was my experiences being on AOT, because I'm in New York State, and I've been on AOT for 2.5 years now. And the thing
that's
was...
New York's involuntary outpatient commitment laws, right? So in case anybody doesn't know what AOT is. Okay.
Yeah, the acronym AOT actually stands for Assisted Outpatient Treatment. It's involuntary outpatient commitment. But I was supposed to be off it in June this month, and I think June 16th. I was actually promised that I was given their word that they weren't going to renew it. I had 2 documents saying that they weren't going to renew it. And I had the psychiatrist I was seeing at the time gave me pretty much a verbal agreement that it was an understanding that they weren't going to renew it. So I thought I was pretty much out of the woods. And then the new psychiatrist I'm seeing now said that the county wants to renew it for a full year. It was being renewed at 6-month increments, and the last one was 3 months, but now they want to renew it for a full year, so they basically went back on their word. I'm going to try to appeal it. I don't know if there's an appeal process, but I'm going to go to court whenever the court date is, and I'm going to see the lawyer could do something for me. But the one psychiatrist I'm seeing now did say that he's going to contact my original psychiatrist, and maybe my original psychiatrist will vouch for me and say don't renew it, but I doubt that's going to happen.
I'm so sorry you're going through this. And would you explain, because I don't think that people can get their heads around or even are aware of the fact that, like, what a court proceeding is like, and I've asked you before, like, did you even know that there was such a thing as this kind of court? But could you give people an idea of what, like, the going to court for whether or not you have to be psychiatrically drugged is like?
Yeah, sure. It's basically what happens is you have a court hearing. There's I'm a provided a mental health legal hygiene lawyer by the county. The other side, the psychiatrist, has their own lawyer. There's a judge. There's no jury. There's no jury at all. It's just you, your lawyer, the psychiatrist, their lawyer, the county's lawyer, and the judge. And basically, your lawyer presents gets up and talks. And if you want to fight the petition, they'll present their case. The county psychiatrist and the county's lawyer will present their case, and then the judge will make a decision. But almost all the time, in my experiences, every time that I've been in the court, they've always sided with the psychiatrist. And from the stories that I've heard from other people that I went through this and things that I've read and done my own research on, they pretty much like 90% of the time, it's the judge always sides with the psychiatrist. So there's like no way out of it. Even if you have a good case, they're still going to side with the psychiatrist. Just how it is.
I'm just wondering when the psychiatrist lawyer gets up, what kind of stuff do they say? Can you just expand on that a little bit of what that's like being on the receiving end of hearing somebody who is prosecuting you for what? Like, how do they even begin to argue this?
Well, the psychiatrist lawyer will say things like what's in your chart, like what symptoms they're saying you're experiencing, and any problems you've had in the past, if you had any interactions with the police or things like that. The doctor, the psychiatrist, actually takes the stand and testifies, The last time I was in the court, because the last court hearing I waived, I didn't because I was pretty much told that they weren't going to renew it, so I wasn't going to fight it, so I waived it. I waived my right to a court hearing, but the court hearing before that I went, and the psychiatrist was saying things that really some of it wasn't like outright lies, but it was like it was sounded like it was like they were twisting the truth a little bit to like meet their own ends. Like they do that all the time, just to, so they could get you on the AOT for however long they're putting you in for.
Right,
but the lawyer.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say the lawyer will because I don't understand like the lawyers go back and forth with the legal jargon, but basically the lawyers they're basically reinforcing whatever the psychiatrist is saying, and like my lawyer would try to defend me, but the thing is what I was thinking was. I have a county appointed lawyer. They're basically on the same side as the psychiatrist lawyer, you know, because they all work for the county. So it doesn't even make sense for me to have a county lawyer, but that's how they do things.
Right, and I'm just looking at the Office of Mental Health's website about the data that they put out about the involuntary outpatient commitment program AOT. And in New York, the petitions filed since November of 1999, there have been 12,050 petitions filed, and 11,698 of them have been granted at a 97% rate of petitions granted. And when it comes to people who are already under... or who are already under AOT, the court order renewals, the average renewal rate is 64% are renewed over the time of the law existing. And, you know, it just seems to me that people need to be further aware about what it's like to have a lawyer who is a county-appointed lawyer who may not necessarily support what it is that you actually want, and how to interact with them in a way so that they really do represent your interest as opposed to the interest of the psychiatric industry. I think that this is just such a crucial thing, and one of the things that gets talked about a lot these days is what's called the black robe effect of the power that the judge has socially, that even if they can't make you comply with drugs or something like that, simply a judge telling you that you must do this is enough to scare people into thinking that they really must comply. And Anthony, I want to thank you for speaking out and talking about this, because there are so many people all over the country and the world that are being subjected to these kinds of experiences.
Yeah.
To know that you're not alone inside of this. Is there some message that you would give people that are going through this of how to survive it or anything that you...
Yeah, I know for sure it's going on all over the place, and my only one word of advice would be to be, I guess, to comply, because if you don't comply, then they're going to say you're symptomatic, you're having another psychotic break, and they're going to put you on more medication, and they may even put you on in the inpatient hospitalization. A lot of times when you become non-compliant, that's what happens. Basically what happens if you were to become non-compliant is they... Like, if you don't show up for your therapy sessions with the therapist, or if you don't show up for medication, they'll call you. And if you don't respond, then they'll send the police to your house.
The police.
And if the police come to pick you up, because they have a pickup order, and they'll pick you up. Basically, what happens is they pick you up and they bring you to hospital, and then you get hospitalized inpatient for however long they want to keep you. At that point, you're basically not going to get out of it. You're going to be probably on AOT indefinitely. Like, they say they're going to renew it, but if that happens, it's even more problematic. It's just more problems. So my word of advice is just do whatever they say, be as compliant as possible, and just there has to be an end to it, because they can't have you on AOT forever. But I would just be as compliant as possible and do what they say. And I know it's not great, but if you don't, then they'll send the police for you, and they'll put you in a hospital.
And this is for no quote unquote crime committed often, right? This is just because somebody has gotten some kind of somebody has been targeted as somebody who's not taking these psychiatric drugs, which have a ton of negative side effects and life. Some even life-threatening and life-limiting, for sure. We know of a clear 15 to 30-year loss of life for people who are on these psychiatric drugs. Anthony and Sue, please stay on the line. We do have another caller from area code 609. Your line is open.
Yeah, this is Jason from South Jersey.
Hi, Jason. I'm listening. Hi, Sue.
I'm just listening to this about this assistant outpatient stuff. I do know I use a drop-in center locally, and I know a lot of people who are in a similar situation, and their housing depends on them submitting to these their injections and other things. So I do know a lot of people who are in a similar maybe situation with that. And I've never been subjected to that. What was I saying? I don't know what to say. I mean, all I could think of is I think of the three F's of psychiatry: fear, fraud, and force. It's amazing that they can control people in that way. I mean, it astounds me whenever I hear
it really
describe
is. And the fear that the psychiatry creates when somebody is experiencing this, how this is supposed to alleviate any kind of
emotional
crisis.
Right. I mean, how is this supposed to impact your health and well-being? I mean, by putting you in that situation, whatever your experiences are, whatever they want to call them, if you've had, and really, it's like you have a reputation, like a psychiatric, just having that label and having your experiences cataloged in that way, and it's just incredible. I can't. It's like mind blowing, and that it's so. And that it is happening everywhere. I mean, I come into contact with dozens of people who are in that situation every day. So that's so true. You're not alone. And I'll just keep listening, because I just wanted to comment, I just think about this stuff all the time. I mean, I can't sleep at night, because I could potentially be in that situation if something happened. You know, I've had the police come to my house. I've called hotlines and warm lines, and unfortunately, one night I called 911 because I was in a severe crisis, but and I wasn't getting support from my family, the support that I wanted, and I was calling numbers, and I had the police come and take me away and lock me up. But I refused medication, and but I've never been in that situation. I can't. It would just. I just think of how. I just know it would add to my distress hugely. And I'm already so damaged from being drugged for like over 20 years, and then being electroshocked on top of that, that my functioning is so bad that I just it's just outrageous.
it um It really is, and I think that this is such an important thing for people to realize. And New Jersey, I believe, just recently had a involuntary outpatient commitment law put forward. I think it was one of the more recent states in 2010. I believe their involuntary outpatient commitment law was put into effect. And so, Anthony, I'm wondering this idea of fear, and you know, David Oakes, I remember when I was talking to him, he put forward this idea to me that there are the three F's of mental health: the fear, force, fraud, and fear. And he saw fear as the real big one, that this is the real big human rights violation, that people don't know what it is that they're doing, having some kind of emotional issue, and all they hear from the larger society is, you know, take medication, medication works, you need to be on medication, you need to be on medication, and that idea that there are no other ways of going about dealing with it. And I'm just wondering if you could inform people about what that experience is like and what it's like having this idea that in any given second they could send the police to you and pick you up and bring you in, and how that winds up affecting your day-to-day kind of issues, or if it does.
That's always a thought in my mind, like, God forbid, if anything were to ever happen where the police were involved, they're gonna automatically think, oh, he's off his medication, he's going crazy again. But that's always in the back of my mind, that the police could always come and pick me up against my will and bring me to the hospital, and they could do things against my will in the hospital. Even if I'm say if I'm in a therapy session, or if I'm talking to the doctor. And they perceive something that I may say. See, when I'm talking to them, I really watch what I say, because I know it could be used against me. And I know if they want, they could always have, because the hospital that I go to, there's a Rockland County Sheriff's substation right there. So they
in the hospital.
Be like, yeah, right there in the hospital. Sheriff's right there. So they could it's a substation. So basically, if something were to, If they wanted to, they could have a sheriff there in like 5 minutes, not even. Because when I was in the one section of the hospital, I was seeing them walking around all the time. Oh. But that's always in the back of my mind, that they could always. I got to constantly walk on eggshells and watch what I say when I'm talking to these people, because they could use it against me and say, oh, he's going psychotic again. He's got to go in the hospital and get more medication that against as well. That's, you know what I mean?
I'm just trying to get my head around this, and for people who may be listening who aren't familiar with this experience, or you know, in all of the years that I was both, you know, involved with psychiatric whatever, and then especially within the training that I've received, and certainly in teaching psychology, one of the things that I always really stress to people is that you have to have a very non-judgmental, open kind of position when people are sharing with you their experiences to understand, and that it has to be an environment of where people can speak freely and really deal with hard issues they may be struggling with, or feelings of loss, or feelings of maybe somebody who is, you know, feeling like they don't want to be alive, or they don't have anything to be alive for, that people need to, in a therapeutic situation, be able to speak freely about this in order to heal. That it's through the talking and communicating that the healing process occurs. So if you have to be watching every word that you're saying, because if you say something that seems, by their judgment, off to them, that they can just, you know, call the cop downstairs and have them come up and take you in, that just seems to me to be so counterproductive to what are true therapeutic practices. And it doesn't sound like it would be anything that would be trauma-informed. In any kind of way.
No. It actually turns these, your states, your words, your, you know, into psychosis is like a crime. you know, you say the wrong thing and you can get mm-hmm. you can get picked up. It's definitely non-therapeutic and not counterprotective. I would agree with that.
And I wanted to say, yeah. too, it's also dangerous. I'll tell you, I had a friend, Nigel, and anyhow, they said, like in the newspaper, he was agitated and he was jumping around. He was a big guy. Mm-hmm. And the cops sat on his chest, and anyhow, he couldn't breathe and he died. Another story was a friend's nephew, the paddy wagon, the police wagon, was going to bring him to the Royal Ottawa Hospital. As soon as they took him out, he didn't have any handcuffs on, and he took the cop's gun and he shot the cop. Now, I think that's horrible. The guy was horrified to go into the hospital, and he took the cop's gun here in Ottawa and shot the cop. He was terrified. And then my friend, they sat on his chest right in his apartment, and they killed him. So it's not only dangerous, but anyhow, some patients will fight and kill someone because they're afraid, or vice versa, mm-hmm. the cops will kill the person. So this is horrible. And mm-hmm. one time I had a friend, he was in a bar and a guy was beating him up, so he hit him to protect himself, and the guy fell over on the floor and died. And anyhow, he went to the maximum prison in the, what's called the Patangushin, eh? And in mm-hmm. there, they use these, it's called a shock machine, a rod with shock to shock him all the time. And he was agitated. So he was in there for 10 years because someone beat him up and he's trying to protect his life. And the guy he was beating up fell on the ground and hit his head. And they blamed him. So the thing is, with psychiatry, when someone is in fear, they will, you know, like the friend, not a friend of mine, a friend of a friend, he went to the mental health for the forensic ward for 10 years, trying to save his own life in a bar. I know he was drinking and that, but still, the guy was beating him up. He had to do something. But anyhow, the thing is also, too, about electroshock, I forgot to say something. I'm going to make this very short. My group, the ICBE, states that the death rate for electroshock is 1 in 200, and that our group states that electroshock is barbaric, it's inhumane, it's torture, it's unethical, and a crime against humanity. And that's all I got to say. And you'll let the men talk now. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I just had a few things. Yeah.
Well, it certainly is, and I think that, you know, in previous nights we've been talking about crisis, you know, quote-unquote crisis intervention when the police are called and come in and how the police are not the people in the they're not the right role for this kind of experience. And Michael Blair's murder, which the Fort Bend, Texas police are calling a justified shooting, is a perfect example of that, how in, you know, his family was concerned about him. They called the hospital. The hospital refused to assist and told them to call 911. The family was suspicious of the police being involved, so they set up a hidden camera, which by some odd chance wound up catching the entire thing on video, which is how I know about any of this, and through the news that they were able to get this to the news. And in under 6 minutes, they killed him. And 11 shots. They continued to shoot after he was on the floor. And so police are while if there's something criminal, if there's something, you know, that they are the role of people to do that. If there's something criminal going on, obviously the police are the right role of people to come in. But the overwhelming majority of time, there is nothing criminal going on. And they respond in a way that is winds up exasperating a situation, and not necessarily assisting. And because of the authority that they have, people who can be in an emotional crisis will become even more fearful because now there's this authority yelling and screaming and holding guns at somebody, and the idea that somebody who is contemplating ending their own life winds up getting killed by the police. It just shows again how this is the wrong response for people who are struggling. But Anthony, I'm really trying to get this around my head. How is a therapeutic situation supposed to be helpful to somebody if you have to guard what it is you're saying and you can't really express yourself because you're afraid that this may wind up causing you to become institutionalized if you say something? And I'm guessing it's not only the words you say, but I'm guessing it's probably also how they observe how you display your emotions, or whether or not you're open, or if you say nothing, that probably can cause you problems too, I'm imagining. And just to try to inform people of what this is like and how to get around it. And this other thing about having a judge who has no medical training, or lawyers for that matter, who have no psychiatric training, defending or prosecuting or making a determination about medical treatment. How does that even work in society where a psychiatrist or a psychologist needs decades of training in order to make these kinds of decisions, and then somebody with no training gets to ultimately decide?
Yeah. It's not, like, that's bad enough, but the thing with me, which I'm still trying to understand, was last week they had a meeting about my case, about my AOT being renewed, and it was a bunch of people. It was my therapist, the psychiatrist, and then it was like four or five other people, like other doctors that I never met. I don't know who they are. They don't know who I am, and they're all making decisions about my life and what's going to happen with my own life. Like, they were the ones that recommended for me to go on back to be my AOT renewed. These people that I never even met, I don't even know who they are, I never heard of them.
Were you there?
Yeah, no, I wasn't there at all, no.
Oh, so that whole idea of nothing about me without me isn't even being established in these very life affecting. So you have a bunch of doctors, so what are they relying on, like case notes of, or like other people's perceptions, or how are they even making the decision?
Because with the facility that I'm at, they have a chart on me, and I guess they go from the notes that are in the chart and what the therapist says and what the doctor says. But the new doctor only knows me. I only had about three or four visits with him already. He doesn't really know me that well.
Have you ever had the opportunity to review your charts for accuracy? Do you get to write in your charts?
I requested to have my files released a couple years ago, and I never got around to reading them because I had a problem when I was hospitalized, and then all of a sudden those charts disappeared somehow. I don't know where they are. Somebody must have thrown them out.
Yeah, that happens.
Because I mean, I got in a bunch of years ago when HIPAA was passed, and people should know that under HIPAA, you're allowed to go get your records. And although sometimes they redact large parts of it and black out all kinds of pieces, and when I went and got my records, I didn't know who they were talking about. I don't even think they knew who they were talking about, because you would read within, 12 hours, different people's perspectives of who it was that I was, and it didn't even sound like they were talking about the same person, even based on how they described how I looked. The descriptions were so off, and then there are these pages that have black lines just running through them of where I guess I'm not allowed to know what people were writing about me. But it is your right under the Health Insurance Portability Privacy Accountability Act, under HIPAA, to get your records. But if they're just making these decisions off of records that may not be kept well, this probably adds to why the renewal rate is so high at 60-some-odd% of AOT orders in New York being renewed. And so I encourage people to go find your medical records and give your input into them. I do want to give out the number again if you want to call in. It's area code 267-521-0167. area code 267-521-0167.
Lauren, I want to say something that's very painful that I haven't shared in public. I have online. My cousin Marcel was in his early 20s. He had a little girl, and his wife was pregnant, and they separated for some type of reason. I don't know what. He went to the same hospital in Ottawa that I did, the Royal Ottawa Hospital. He had a car in the parking lot. So he was on a lock board, and someone opened the door, and anyhow, he ran off. He escaped, went to his Mustang. He went to the Champlain Bridge that has the rapids. He parked on the bridge, and a witness said he jumped into the rapids, and he died. In 1989, he died. Committed suicide. And I have a friend. Her sister was in the Kingston Psych Hospital and was so upset being there, she ran out, and she had a little dress on, and anyhow, that it was the middle of winter, and she froze to death. Some people are so upset, they run out of the hospital, and they die, or they kill themselves. And about my cousin, I live near the Ottawa River, and when I take my wheelchair, I see that bridge. I went there 2 years ago with a friend of mine, and I went to the rapids. It's very hard to go to the rapids because I was able to walk then, and a friend of mine held me because I have problems with my legs then, too. And I went by the rapids by the fence, and I cried and cried for an hour. I said, don't leave me. And just to... and then his son was born a few years later. So she, anyhow, and that his wife, she works at the Civic Hospital here. But the thing is, it's so painful for me when I go down to the pathway, the parkway, huge parkway, and I see that bridge. Every time I look at it, I always remember. And I didn't go to the funeral because I was at the psych ward at the, it's called the Queensway Carlton Hospital. I missed his funeral. So the thing is, you know, that psychiatry is dangerous, it's harmful, and that it ruins a lot of people's lives. It ruined my life because I didn't get a career because I can't learn because I can't remember from electroshock. I'm in poverty. It's not because I want to be, because I couldn't get the career I wanted. I can't learn. I can't learn. And you can't get a degree, you can't get a higher education, because I had the aptitude, but I can't learn anymore. Since 1973, I went to college, and I had to work twice as hard. And in college, a teacher said to me, why are you stalling for the test, Suzanne? She says, you really got good brains. I didn't want to tell her I had electroshock and I have to study twice as hard. So I lost a career. I never had a career. I was a secretary. I mean, it's an easy thing to be a secretary, answering phones and typing. But I wanted to be a lawyer. I could have been a doctor. I mean, like a doctor, not a psychiatrist, maybe a psychologist or whatever. And so what they do, and I've heard of people, okay, that were artists and they couldn't do painting. I've heard of lawyers that couldn't remember, and they lost their careers that they had. Okay, so
Jason, are you trying to...
Yeah, I'm just thinking about what Sue's saying, you know, about her trouble, her problems still. You know, she had five, you know, she had five electroshocks in 1973, I think you said, but I had 23 in 2010, and those are the kinds of problems that I'm having. I can't really, I no longer do my creative work, painting and drawing and other things that I used to make, woodwork and things like that. I taught myself how to make pipes, and I worked with lathes and was mechanical, and I now have a workshop downstairs full of machinery that I don't know how to use and have really no aptitude for using anymore. And those were things I learned maybe, you know, in 5 or 6 years prior to the electroshock. I used to do, you know, I used to just buy and sell things on eBay. I can no longer use eBay. Lots of things like that. And, I mean, it really is a destructive treatment, not only of memory, but of your cognitive ability. It probably lowers IQ by like 30 or 40 points. It's usually about what it does, which is like a third of your intelligence. I know you still have, I've heard people describe it as you still you're still intelligent, but you have no longer have the ability to use your intelligence, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Use it in a way, you know, to set goals and then carry that out. And right now, that's what I'm going through. I'm going through, how am I going to face this the rest of my life? There's so many things that I wanted to do that I know I will no longer be able to do, even with effort. And what I'm still able to do is, it's really a daily struggle. Every day, every morning, I wake up and it's like, oh my God, I've got to do this again. You know, I've got to. Just everything is so chaotic. I mean, after I had to relearn how to like brush my teeth. I was struggling with taking a shower, cooking. I used to love to cook. I couldn't find my way around the kitchen, and that hasn't entirely cleared up. I had nerve damage in my leg. I had foot drop, which is a neurological thing. It damaged the nerve so badly that for about 9 months, my right foot was just hanging. I had no control over it. It was completely numb, and there was numbness on my right outside of my lower leg, in my arm, in my fingers. They were just completely numb. That did clear up. I do a lot of exercise now and cycling and walking. I try to stay active, but just to deal with the anxiety because so much is missing, and it's caused me so much anxiety and distress, which is just constant. But I understand what Sue's saying exactly, and I've heard that many other people say the same things. I talk with other people who. Especially another woman in Oregon who's been through this, and she's supported me. We supported each other through some of this. And I've also knew a guy who committed suicide about a year after the electroshock. Who we were talking to on the phone, trying to support him. He was in utter panic, and this guy was an engineer, an aviation engineer or something for Boeing. And his family completely rejected him. His wife, his kids, and his life just fell apart, and he lost it, and he shot himself. This has been maybe a year after the electroshock, and apparently that's common within the first year if you don't survive.
So tragic.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like it really is a barbaric, and if you survive it, life becomes, at least, it's like torture. It's like living every day in a kind of tortured state of angst.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, and also I feel, I feel trapped. I can't, because of the cognitive damage, I often feel trapped, and I've tried to use supports in the community. I've used the drop-in center, but I am fearful of coming into contact with. Oh, I did want to say one thing. After the electroshock, I called John Breeding, or I emailed him and asked him if he knew of anyone in my area, because he's in Texas, and I asked him if he knew anyone on the East Coast who would work with people who had been, damaged by psychiatry or through electroshock or drugs, and he did give me the name of someone. So I've been seeing a therapist for 3 years, just counseling, talking, who's helped me through it and supported me through it. And he belongs to ISAP, which is the International Society for Ethical Psychiatry and Psychology. And I even went to one of their conferences and met a lot of people there from all over. But he's been working with me, so I'm thinking about Anthony and how he's kind of he's got so many strengths. You want to go back to school and finish your degree and you work. I just think about how terrible it is to feel hemmed in by the system and by having a label and having to navigate all that.
right? And I just want to, Anthony, if you just, for 1 second, I want to just say that the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry, their website is psychintegrity.org, www.psychintegrity.org, and they're a great resource for people, and they give access to all psychologists and psychiatrists who are acting ethically. And their conference is the 17th annual conference of ICEP is going to be focusing on transforming mad science and reimagining mental health care. And that's going to be in November 13th to the 15th of 2014 in Culver City, California. If you can't get there, the website definitely has a phenomenal amount of information about alternatives and about psychologists and psychiatrists who are acting in an ethical manner and who are challenging the biomedical model of psychiatry. And so I think that's a really good resource. Thanks for bringing that up. Anthony.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, you know, Jason, the funny thing is the psychiatrist told me that I was suffering from delusions of grandeur because I wanted to go back to school, and I'm actually going to do it now. That's kind of ironic.
Yeah, right. they actually say that. That's unbelievable. I mean, recovery should be based on your strengths and not on your perceived, these weaknesses or these terminology they use. If they were really concerned about your well-being, you know, they would help you develop your strengths as a person. But it is really, psychiatry is like extra legal police force, police control or social control. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're not really there to support you to make healthy choices. They're there to protect others.
Yeah.
I think.
And then that's where so much of the fraud comes in, right? And this idea that, that people's goals or desires in life can be categorized out as a delusion of grandeur or
a
something
delusion.
It really is. This is where the big crime comes in for me. On, you know, once you get past the crimes of the drugging and the electroshock and restraints and seclusion and the way that we're treated on a physical level, what they do psychologically, how they break people down. This was as far back, at least as far back as Goffman in 1961. He wrote out specifically this two-stage process that is used systemically to turn a person into a mental patient.
Mm-hmm.
To take somebody who has a life, degradation is exactly right, to take somebody who has a life and goals and rip those goals away from them and tell them that they can't do the things that they want to do because it's either too stressful or they can't handle it or it's not in their reach, and that what they should do is be on disability, be on drugs, and go to group and provide this service provider with a job. And to me, this is where the real definition of slavery and psychiatric slavery comes, that we are, our life, liberty, and fortune is under the control of these people. And that, Anthony, good for you for going and getting back into school and for continuing your dreams, because people somehow believe these authorities because we're trained in our society to believe the doctor and to trust the doctor. And the doctor doesn't want us to be the doctor, and they want us to stay down, that the only way that we're going to be safe is if we're compliant with what it is that they say, and that's not true. And I just want to mention, because it's, you know, suicide's come up a few times tonight, and if there are people who are listening who are struggling and who are having this kind of contemplation, that there are alternatives, there are ways to get around this, and there are natural support systems that you can get hooked up into, by and that there is hope. and that you can get out of this situation, and no matter how bad it is, that there are ways that you can get your life back, and to take your own life would be the biggest loss to society. And that, you know, to reach out for supports to these alternative kinds of places, mindfreedom.org, the Alliance's 800-support line is 800-654-7227. That's 800-654-7227. There are places and people that you can contact that aren't going to immediately call in, and that are going to let you talk openly and freely and honestly to heal. And then also we talked last night a little bit about the guide, the trauma-informed care guide for peer support, and to understand that trauma, so for so many of us, trauma is at the base of what is going on, and that there are ways to resolve that trauma, you know, that no matter how bad it seems, there are people who are available to help, and the power of peer support and self-help, it really makes a big difference in one's experience. And so I just want to put that out there for people so that they maybe get another idea that just because you're having these experiences doesn't mean that you're less than human, or that you don't deserve the life that anybody else can get. You know, not that it's not without its work, because I can testify to the amount of work that it takes, but work well worth it. And that people shouldn't allow themselves to be limited because somebody else has assigned them in these ways.
Yeah, I mean, part of, you know, thriving, I mean, if you really can thrive, and Anthony, and, you know, you can, I mean, part of that is struggle, but you should be free to struggle and not have to, you know, tolerate all this outside control of your life, you know. That's done, and it's all legal, you know. It's legal. It's state power. That's just so frightening. I don't know how. Mind Freedom was great too. After the electroshock, I don't know. There were some, you know, and signing up for the Mind Freedom Shield was helpful. Having that. I don't know if you know what that is. I know Lauren does.
Yeah. The Mind Freedom Shield will, if you through mindfreedom.org, you can get in. And so what it does is you set it up for how you want it used, and it can be found at the at mindfreedom.org. And what it does is it triggers. At your request, I want to be specific here, at an individual's request, it triggers a call to all Mind Freedom members to support people. And so if a member with a shield, I'm just reading off of their website right now, if a member with a shield is threatened with coerced psychiatry, that member can instantly activate a public alert system where all Mind Freedom members will then respond to the place where you're being forced or subjected to being forced with letters and phone calls in support for you to be freed. And we've seen it be quite successful a number of times. And one of the times that is most significant in my mind is when Ray Sanford in Minnesota was being outpatient commitment forced to electroshock 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And Mind Freedom members just had an all-out campaign to stop that electroshock, and eventually they did stop it. And so this idea of using mutual support to protect one another from unwanted coerced psychiatric procedures is another resource for people to know is out there. So, Jason, thanks for bringing that up, because I think that not enough people are aware of it. And to know that Mind Freedom's membership is over 10,000 people,
Wow.
who are actively working to try to eliminate this kind of forced psychiatry and torture. That this is torture. It's been ruled torture by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture, and the United States, and I think Canada, Sue, correct me if I'm wrong, are just not in compliance, as many places in the world are not in compliance with the Convention Against Torture. And part of that goes back to the idea that we're less than human and need to be controlled. And that is just simply not true. And we need to continue voicing these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say something, too, okay, like about the campaign to help Ray Sanford. Okay, I called him. I'm part of Mind Freedom. And I had made a YouTube video, and I said, and anyhow that I wrote an email, okay, and I sent it to the governor, but I made a YouTube video pleading for them to stop the electroshocks for Ray. And I called him a few times, and he was very despondent, very upset. I said, Ray, I said, we're going to help you. The whole groups are going to help you. I said, and he was very despondent. And then a lot of times, okay, that he got a call from David. He called Ray quite a bit, and he got a lot of support.
Mm-hmm.
But when I spoke to him, he sounded very upset. I said, I'm so sorry. But he said that the phone calls are helping to keep his hope. But the thing I wanted to tell you, too, is in Canada, we have a big problem now. The police services, the RCMP, the OPP, and the police across the country have done this, and the doctors and the mental health services have collected all the medical mental files of people who have been labeled suicidal, 19,000 cases. I'm probably, okay, like in that case, because I have been suicidal, and it's been like a documented thing. A lady of 63 years old in Toronto, she's going to the States, and she had her passport. She did nothing wrong, but in 1989, she was suicidal, and anyhow that her partner had called the police 911, she went to the psych hospital, and they documented Mrs. So-and-so has been suicidal. So she said, hello, there's my passport. They looked at her name and said, sorry, miss, but you do have, you don't have the entry to the USA. Why? They took her to her room and said, we know on your medical mental charts that you've been suicidal. We can't allow you back into the USA until you get a doctor saying basically, okay, that you're okay. Now, I think it's a privacy issue because I know I'm on that list because I've been suicidal many times. I haven't been for many, many years. But if I want to go to the States, let's say, to visit somebody, they would stop me because my name would be there, right? They say, Mrs. Wittenberg, Sue Clark Wittenberg, you're not allowed into the States. You've got to get a psychiatrist or doctor to say you're okay. I find that horrible. I find that against our privacy. And the Ombudsman for Ontario, she wants to look into this. But I think it's horrible that you plan a trip and you don't even know about this happening and they say, come with us. I think it's horrible. And so I know right now at this minute, I've been suicidal. I almost lost my life twice. I took a whole bottle of pills in 84, almost died. I was in intensive care. And then I tried to hang myself at 17, but a nurse intervened. So I know that as a Canadian, I'm a natural-born Canadian. I was born in Ottawa. If I were to see, like, go to the States, I got my passport ready, I will not be allowed in.
I
19,000 cases documented. Like,
Sue, I think that this is a major issue, and I want to just point people to psychcentral.com, where Dr. John Grohl has been writing about this. And it is absolutely true that the RCMP knows when people are suicidal and tells the U.S. This is major privacy invasion, and there are databases that are being kept on us. And the idea that people cannot cross into another country because of a psychiatric history is just horrifying to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was thinking.
They should just make us wear, you know, gold stars or something. That's what it's like.
It really does. And the idea of that this information is being shared with other countries is such a violation of privacy rights and illegitimate in so many ways, because somebody has a history of where at some point in their life they may have contemplated ending it to prevent them from being able to enjoy the rights and freedoms of all people. How does that in any way encourage somebody to not want to contemplate these things? So many of the responses to somebody not being satisfied with life wind up causing so much more dissatisfaction.
That goes right back to what you were saying about Irving Goffman and the becoming a being conditioned to become a mental patient. Just the ideology. You're right. It leads to thinking that this to desperate thinking.
It really does, and I want to just give the website for the Engaging Women in Trauma-Informed Peer Support, a guidebook, and I'd like to just clarify that it works for men also, or people of any gender. It's regardless of gender. But it was a publication of the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, and it can be found at nashbid.org/publications/engagingwomen.aspx. And this was written by Andy Blanche, Darby Penny, Beth Stilson, and with contributions from Kathy Cave. And it has a phenomenal amount of information about healing from trauma. And we know that upwards of 96% of people of adults in state-sponsored psychiatric facilities have histories of trauma and abuse in their lives. And this guidebook really breaks down and has some great stuff around spirituality and culture and what trauma is and how to go about healing from these things. And the chapter 3 on peer support fundamentals, I think, is really important for anybody to read because it gives you some insight into what true peer support is about and not the fabricated versions of where you have people who have psychiatric histories telling you to take your psychiatric drugs and the way that it's been bastardized through the formalized peer support programs that are happening in states now.
What's the title of this again? Trauma-informed care.
It's called Engaging Women in Trauma-Informed Peer Support, a guidebook. But I think personally, having read it, I think it applies to anybody. I don't think it's limited to just women, but does specifically address gender politics and the criminalization of women, which obviously is a main issue that we're constantly battling with. And so I'm just reading off the website. It's designed as a resource for peer supporters in settings who want to learn how to integrate trauma-informed principles into their relationships with women they support or into peer support groups which they are members. And I think that the way that they lay out the how to do this and how to deal with trauma, because that's the alternative model that nobody wants. And certainly Murphy and the Murphy Bill, H.R. 3717, which would, they're making a direct strike on trauma-informed care and on peer support services, and will wipe out those kinds of things if H.R. 3717 is passed as it is. It would also wipe out protection and advocacy for individuals with, quote, mental illness, the PAMI boards, and it will institute a national mandate for every state to have an involuntary outpatient commitment law. I think there are 5 states left that don't have involuntary outpatient commitment laws at this point in time. And so the Engaging Women in Engaging Women in Trauma-Informed Peer Support is the title of that guidebook.
Okay.
I think would be really useful for people. And there's so many things that are going on that of where we're being attacked, of how they use these tragic and heinous murders as a way to push forward their agenda. This morning, the director of the Treatment Advocacy Center was on C-SPAN for almost a full, over a full half hour, pushing this idea that involuntary outpatient commitment is going to solve all of the world's problems and eliminate these kinds of heinous acts, and it's just not true. And if they really wanted to end these kinds of things, they would start looking at trauma-informed care. They would look at gun laws in general. And then what a lot of the feminists are talking about is they would start really addressing this idea of sexual entitlement and misogyny, and that if people were held accountable to what it was they were doing instead of just diagnosing it off and riding on our backs, the overwhelming majority of people who have psychiatric histories, and they'll say this, they say, well, no, people with psychiatric histories aren't really more violent than anybody else. Well, no, the overwhelming majority of murders and crimes are not committed by people with psychiatric histories. Yet, yet we want this law to make it stop, and so it's convoluted, and it's a scam, is what it is. And so it's going to be more taxpayer dollars into a system that is damaging and destructive, and not really supporting people's human rights or helping them on any real level. And if you'd like to get involved in these kinds of things and speak out, mindfreedom.org, the Creative Revolution Conference is going to be July 24th through the 27th in Connecticut. And I will be attending that conference, and it's a great place to meet like-minded people and create more of a support network for yourself and learn a lot of really great information and get connected. The Mental Patients Liberation Alliance will be hosting the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Days vigil on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health, July 13th at 6 p.m. through July 16th at 6 p.m. And we sit vigil for 72 hours because 72 hours is how long they can pick up, detain, assess, and treat anyone. This is not about involuntary outpatient commitment. This is any single person anywhere in the country, but specifically in New York State, where they can, if somebody calls and says that they think that you're a threat to yourself or somebody else, the police can be called to pick you up, and you can be detained for 72 hours, even if you do not have a psychiatric history. And I think that this is very important for people to realize that this is not specific to having had some kind of interaction with psychiatry before. This is first line of attack. We need to speak out, and institutions are not the places where people are going to heal. They're places of control and places where people are forcibly drugged and held. And if you wind up in an institution, I don't know if this has happened to others, but from the very first moment, you are stripped of your identity, you are stripped of any personal possessions you may have on you, and you are prevented from even being able to call family or loved ones until they deem you being at a certain level for being able to get that it's a reward. So even in prison, you're allowed, or jail, you're allowed your phone call to reach out to somebody to let them know where you are and so on and so forth. In a psychiatric facility, you have none of those rights. And as Anthony mentioned before, all of this is happening without a jury trial. And it is being done based on the observations of an individual, and there are limited amounts of rights that people who wind up getting involved with the psychiatric system have.
Yeah, I could attest to what you just said, Lauren, about being in the inpatient facility, how they take everything away from you. You're not even allowed to have a watch.
It really is. And you know, in this day and age where everybody has a cell phone and has a social network that is well-developed and experienced, that cell phone is taken away from you upon entrance. And you do not have the right to communication when you are locked up in a mental institution. And we know that what works is people feeling like they are in a supportive environment, feeling like they can talk freely to people, feeling like they can express themselves. And all of those things are taken away. And Anthony, as you said before, and I really, really appreciate you sharing this kind of information about what it's like to be fearful of being, you know, having to watch what you say in a therapeutic situation. It's so counterproductive to actually assisting somebody.
Go ahead. I just wanted to ask Lauren, where the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, where are they based? And could you maybe talk about things that we could do if we wanted to volunteer?
Yes.
At some level.
The headquarters of the Alliance are in Utica, New York, but there are members all over New York State, and the bulk of the organizing for the Bastille Day event is happening over the telephone because we all live hundreds of miles away from each other. But if you want to get involved with that, you can call the Alliance directly at 800-654-7227. Mm-hmm. It's 800-654-7227, or you can call me at area code 718-273-8708. And every day we're getting more people who are wanting to be involved and who are going to be doing things, and so I think that that's a great opportunity for people. And then also there are trainings on that we do through the Alliance for people who may want to, be on the support line for people who are calling in. So if you're interested in helping keep the Alliance's support line running and being somebody who can be a supportive ear, we do have trainings for those. I don't think that there's one scheduled right now, but we can. The Alliance will be holding those periodically. And so if you have an interest in doing that kind of thing, that's also another availability. And so George Ebert of the Alliance is a person to contact at 800-654-7227, or you can contact me directly.
Okay. Lauren, I have a question about the Creative Revolutions Conference that Mind Freedom International is hosting. I emailed them and they never got back to me yet. I'm sure they're getting a lot of emails. They probably haven't got to mine yet, but maybe you could help me with this. It's about lodging. Do you have to actually lodge at the Wisdom House there in Litchfield, Connecticut, or could you get like a hotel room, or do you know how that works?
Celia was actually on the other day talking about this, and so they are creating a day rate pass into the conference for people who may just want to travel in and not stay at it. But the registration fee for the conference, if you chose to stay at the house, included everything, including meals and things like that. But they are establishing a day rate for people who may just be traveling in for the day and not looking to stay there. So you do not have to stay at the Wisdom House, but there are several different packages that are being established for that. And so they have the commuter rate, I believe it's called, which would include meals for the day, or there's the package for where there would be for staying at the Wisdom House throughout the entire conference.
Are they going to, if you chose to lodge at Wisdom House, like, do they have like functions and activities like later on during the day and evening that wouldn't be during like a regular daytime hours, or is it just all like, are they going to have a schedule of events posted, or do you know that, or
I don't think the schedule of events is posted yet, but I know that like many conferences, the actual workshops and are great and informative and really worthwhile. So I'm not in any way belittling the actual schedule of the conference. But it is in those times afterwards when people are really connecting with each other, and it goes well into the night of all of the different connections that you can make. And so people aren't, you know, in the conference during the day and then at night, like, huddling in their room by themselves and nothing going on. There's actually plenty of going on in the after parts. And I'm pretty sure that there will be evening kinds of events that are going very often. They'll have like an open mic kind of night, or music, or other things that are happening in the evening. But it's those connections after getting all of this great information all day long, then really sitting around and bonding with people in the evening hours, that for me personally is the part of the conference that I think is the best part. This is where really lifelong friendships can be developed, and I have developed with people through these processes, and I just think that it's great. So I think that if, you know, for commuterates, if you're, you know, coming and going during the day, if you aren't able to stay in the evening, you know, you get a great amount of information and connections during the day, but it's those more informal kinds of experiences that I think where people really get great benefit from. And the Wisdom Lodge itself is, we were there, I don't know, a bunch of years ago, I think it was like 07 or something like that, and it's a fabulous place. It's really a great retreat from the rest of the world. And
is that retreat Wisdom House? You just said it was a cabin. Is that, I just saw a thing, a video about Daniel Mackler's where a bunch of people met. It looked like a cabin by a lake or something. And you guys were talking about you know, coming off psychiatric drugs. Will Hall was there. Daniel Mackler. Laura Duano, other people that I recognize from some of the protests and other stuff. Do you know if that was it? I don't know.
I don't want to say definitely because I'm not sure, but
okay.
It definitely has a lot of amenities, and there's a camaraderie that is developed through these processes just being amongst other Mind Freedom members, it really is a phenomenal experience. And so if you want more information about that, it's mindfreedom.org, you can register there pretty simply. And Anthony, I'm sure that they will be getting back to you in a short amount of time.
Yeah.
We're about to lose our air time here, so I just want to thank you all for calling in and for giving so much of yourselves and sharing this information with people who are listening. If you have an idea for a show or want to be a guest on a special night, or have a news tip that you would like to have investigated, you can call the Talk with Tenny tip line at area code 718-273-8708. That's area code 718-273-8708, 24 hours a day. And you can leave your tip anonymously, or if you want me to follow with you, please make sure you leave your number, and I will get back to you. Thank you all for speaking out. I want to ask you to keep talking. Until next time, talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone. Good night.